Welcome to the weekly sermon podcast of Valley Grove Baptist Church. We are thankful you stopped by to hear from God's Word, to grow closer to Him, and to be inspired to reach your area of influence. If you've got your Bibles this morning, let's go ahead and find Luke chapter 16. Luke chapter 16 this morning. So this morning we're going to finish up our the second part to what we started last week on biblical stewardship. And so today we're going to, you've got a lot for an outline. Normally you don't have this much. And I try to be as judicious as I can about paring out or cutting out as much as I can to get your outline on half a page. It didn't work this week. We also have some slides that we'll show you here in a little bit with some math equations. So, fun, right? Yeah, get you educators and kids back in the swing of going to school after you've been out for a week. So, anyway, today we're going to talk, as I said, a little bit more about what it means to be a generous giver and a good steward of our resources. And what we want to do this morning is we want to talk about a parable in Luke chapter 16, verses 1 and following. Now, I'm going to be honest with you. I need to give you three things up front that will help you out as we look at this parable, okay? Because if I'm being honest, this is one of the most difficult parables of Jesus. Ugh, collective sigh, okay? So, but these three things will potentially, hopefully, maybe, just maybe, make it a little bit easier. All right, here's the first thing you need to understand about this parable. One reason that this parable is a more difficult parable of Jesus. Let me back up. Let me give you four things, one of which is not in your outline. A parable, let's define a parable. A parable is a fictional story with a theological point. Fictional story, theological point. Okay, that's parable. Here's what makes this parable difficult. It's because Jesus uses a negative example to prove a positive point. Okay? So the main character in the story is not a good guy. He's a bad guy. But Jesus is going to use the bad guy to make a positive point. Okay? You with me so far? Fictional story, theological point. This one's difficult. Negative example, positive point. All right, now there's two key words. Well, there's one key word and then another word you need to understand. Because you got to listen to me. You got to get these words. Or in the middle of this parable, as we're reading and talking about it, you're going to get hung up on these two words. All right, here's the first one. Shrewdness. Now, in English, in American English, this word, to me, I hope to you, has a negative connotation. Slimy, deceitful. You know, it's like in the animated movies where the scene turns dark and the music kind of is ominous. That's the idea we think of when we hear the word shrewd or shrewdness. That is absolutely not what the connotation is or the meaning is in the Greek in this passage. Shrewdness here, I've got it in your outline. I want you to look at it right now. Look at it. It means great practical intelligence. Great practical intelligence. Is that a positive or a negative thing? Positive. Very good. All right. Here's the second thing you need to, the second word that I want to give to you, okay? Is unrighteous wealth. At the end of this parable, Jesus is going to talk about unrighteous wealth. And to us, when we hear that phrase, unrighteous wealth, we think of morally corrupt money. Mafia money. Cartel money. You know, that's what we think of. Listen, that phrase in the original language, unrighteous wealth, simply means money. There is no moral connotation to it. At all. No moral connotation to it at all. So when you read that, when we read that here in just a minute, I want you to simply hear the word dollars, bucks, Benjamins. because that's what the phrase means. All right? Shrewdness, not negative, but positive. Unrighteous wealth, no moral connotation. Simply means money. All right, so here's how we're going to roll this morning. This morning, we are going to walk. We're going to read a couple verses and talk about it, and read a couple verses and talk about it. All right, so we're going to read the first two verses, and then we're going to talk about them. All right, so let's read them. He also, that's Jesus. Jesus also said to the disciples, there was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him. That's charges were brought to the master, to the rich man, that this man, the manager, was wasting his possessions. Verse 2. And he called him, and the master called the manager to him and said, what is this that I hear about you? Turn in the account of your management, for you can no longer be manager. All right, here we go. So this is the start of the story. There's two characters. You ready? Master and a manager. The master owns everything. It's his property, and the manager just manages. Great job. Y'all remember from last week, right? Managers manage. What has come to light is that the manager is wasting the master's possessions. And so what does the master do to the manager? You're fired. All right. That's the setup. Here's what's going to happen next. Let's read the next two verses. Verse 3. And the manager said to himself, what shall I do since my master is taking the management away from me? I am not strong enough to dig, and I am ashamed to beg. We would say he is in a pickle. All right, verse 4. I have decided what to do, so that when I am removed from management, people may receive me into their homes. All right, stop right there, because the next verse, you're going to see what he does. But here's the situation, okay? The master and the manager meet. And while they're meeting, and while the master is saying, you're fired, the manager is in his own mind saying, what in the world am I going to do? And in that situation, he comes up with a plan, because he ain't going to beg, and he ain't going to work, right? Not a day laborer, and he's too proud to beg. So he's got to come up with a situation. Now, in verses 5 and 6, we're going to see what he comes up with, the answer to this problem that he's got, all right, of unemployment. Here we go. Let's read verse 5 and 6. All right. Excuse me. So summoning his master's, summoning whose debtors? The master's debtors, one by one, he said to the first, how much do you owe my master? Verse 6. He said, 100 measures of oil. He, that's the manager, said to him, take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Now we got to read one more verse. Verse 7. Then he said to another, and how much do you owe? He said, 100 measures of wheat. He said to him, take your bill and write 80. All right, let's stop right there. Okay, so listen. Follow with me, okay? Before word gets out that the master has fired the manager, that's crucial. Before, this is kind of in between the lines, okay? Before word gets out that the manager has been fired, he calls the master's debtors. Now, these debtors, we would better understand them as sharecroppers, okay? Sharecroppers are people who work on other people's land and they pay for their ability to live and work on the land with a share of the crops they produce, okay? These people who owe measures of wheat and measures of oil are sharecroppers. In other words, they live and work on the master's land and they produce a product, and as payment, they don't pay money, they pay an amount of the product, of agricultural product, to the master, okay? Now, here's the key that you got to remember. Whose debtors are these? Whose sharecroppers are these? The manager or the master's? The master's. So the debt that they owe is not to the manager, it is to the master. And so the manager, before word gets out, goes to the sharecroppers and says, "Hey, bud, what's your bill?" The first one says, 100 measures of oil. And he says, "Hey, what that means for us is that the master and the sharecropper agreed that their debt was 100 measures of oil." And the manager said, "You know what? Let's change that. Let's make that 80. 50. Thank you, Tanner. Paying attention. He said, "Let's change that and make it 50. Now, I'll ask that question in a minute. Then another group of sharecroppers come in. And he says, "Hey, what was your bill with the master? What was your debt to the master?" And they said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said, "Take that and make it 80. Good job. So let me ask you this. These two sharecropper families that left, this is not in verse 8. What do you think their response was when they left this meeting? Were they angry?
No.
So they were elated. Now, this is also not in the text, but I just know people, and if the IRS called you after you've submitted your tax, be like, "Hey," well, they wouldn't call you, they'd send you a letter, but whatever. If you got the letter in the mail and it's like, "Hey, I know you owed us $10,000, but we made a mistake. You only owe us $5,000. You would be like, "Whoa," right? You'd think you'd won the lottery, right? So these people, like, this is what they would do. This is what you would do. You would go out and say, "Man, we have the most benevolent master. All my friends' rent, it went up. And ours went..." Y'all should have a master like we do. If only y'all were with us. Your bill wouldn't have gone up this year. It would have gone down. Also, second question. On whose authority would the sharecroppers believe that these changes were being made? The master's. Why? Because their debt is with the... Therefore, they heaped great joy and great praise and great honor on the master, because the manager is just managing, right? So the manager has presented this situation that now the master has to deal with, right? Let's read verse 8. Key word, key phrase in this. We're going to stop after the first period. The master commended the dishonest manager for his what? Not slimy backhandedness, but for his great practical intelligence. In other words, Jesus has the master, knowing the manager is what? What's the word he uses? Dishonest, because it's underhanded. He was already fired when he made these changes. But he has the master saying that he did this with great practical intelligence. He gave him a pat on... Did he give him his job back? No. But he gave him a pat on the back and as he went out and said, "Man, that was pretty smart. That was pretty smart what you did." And you say, "Well, why was it pretty smart?" Here's why it's pretty smart. Kenneth Bailey, a great author on the New Testament, said, in the culture of Jesus, the manager has put the master in a bind. And the master is left with two equally options. You can do one or the other. He said the first option is he can act like it was his idea and he can receive the honor and the praise and the joy of his sharecroppers. Or he can go back to him and he can say, "Hey guys, here's the deal. Minutes before he called you, I just fired him. And that made all of those changes to your bill null and void. And so I know you got excited that you were going to owe me less than what we originally agreed on, but I'm actually going to need you to go back to that original." Now, if he chooses option 2, what is the reaction of the people?
that sorry, good-for-nothing master. I can't believe him. You wait till I see my friends. Right? Now, Jesus doesn't tell us like which one the master chooses, right? Because it's not really relevant to the story. But the idea is that he probably chooses the first one because he commends the manager for acting with great practical intelligence. Now the parable, that's the parable. Now Jesus is going to give us the interpretation and that's relevant for the disciples who heard this and for me and you today. Look what he says. For the sons of this world, let's go back to verse 8. Let me finish reading that one. For the sons of this world, lost people, pagans, unbelievers, are more, there's that word again, acting with great practical intelligence in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. Verse 9. And I tell you, make friends for yourself by means of money, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings, i.e. heaven. Now, you may be like, what is Jesus saying here? We'll break it down to you. It's really simple. Really simple. You ready? Listen to me. Listen to me. This is Jesus is reeling you in. He's got you hooked. He's about to reel you in with this parable, okay? Here it is. Very simple. 8b and 9 simply say this. Lost people, pagans, know how to use their money for the purposes they care about. And my people don't. And you need to start. You want proof? Proof. This country over here is bad. We should go invade them. We should kill them all. And we should put a new government in. See? Watch. Watch the news. Watch the news. Watch the news. All while behind the, you think I'm crazy, but all while behind the scenes, the people who are funding that are the people who make all the military equipment. And they're going to make billions of dollars. Or, hey, you should buy this toothpaste. This toothpaste really gets your teeth clean. More clean than this toothpaste, even though they're probably made in the same factory. You should buy this fishing rod. It's better. Look, you can bend it all the way over and it doesn't break. And look, I'll show you it with me catching this enormous fish. Right? All while they're all made in like five factories in China somewhere. LGBTQ agenda, regime change, wars, rumors of wars, what car you should buy is all what? I won't put them all in this category, generally speaking, sons of the world using their money for the things they care about. Paid protesters. Come on, guys. And look at me, and look at me. And what does the church do? Barely scrapes by. Why? Because they know how to use their money for the agendas they care about. And the don't blame. Hey, look. Go back to verse 8. Ren, go back to verse 8. Not me. I'm not saying it. King of the world, Jesus is saying it. More than the sons of light. What is Jesus saying? You and I need to figure out how to use our money to advance the agendas we care about the most. And the agenda we should care about the most is making sure people make it into heaven, i.e. the kingdom of God. Right? So in other words, he's saying we should take a page out of the dishonest manager's playbook and use it for kingdom purposes. Now you say, well, I don't know if that's right. Well, that's okay. Let's read verses 10 through 13. Here we go. Verse 10, Jesus expounds on this explanation. One who is faithful in a very little is also faithful in much. That makes sense. And one who is dishonest in very little is also dishonest in much. That's true as well. Now let's read verses 11. If then you have not been faithful in money, unrighteous wealth, who will entrust you with true riches? No one. Verse 12. And if you have not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No one. Verse 13. No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. In other words, if verse 13 is true, and we believe it is, I believe it is because Jesus says it, you cannot serve both God and money. You'll either serve one or the other. And we should be using our money to forward God's kingdom. What should we be doing? We should be biblical stewards of our resources, advancing the causes we care about the most. And the cause we should care about the most is God's kingdom. Because at the end of the day, all of this burns away. And at the end of the day, ain't none of us taking it with us to heaven in a U-Haul. And so what we should care about the most is how can we advance God's kingdom with the resources God has given us. And in this parable, that specifically, listen to me, that specifically refers to money. All right? So that's the parable. Now, the question is, how do we do that? And the answer is by tithing and by generous giving. So in your outline, we're now on the back page. All right? So let's talk about that for just a minute. All right? And talk about how that's going to relate to you and I today. So here's how I want to end this. Here's how I want to kind of this. I would say this part is like all application today. It may be a little more applicable at the very, very end. But I want to make you aware of something just so you know what you're about to get into. Okay? One, this will be personal. All right? It will be personal. I mean it for that. I mean it to be that way. I will give you a couple hot takes here at the beginning. I'm going to be very blunt and very honest and then very benevolent back right after that a couple of times, okay? So hang with me through the blunt. Don't cut me off. I promise you need to hear it as much as I need to hear it, and then we'll be benevolent, and then we'll kind of move, okay? So here's hot take number one. Here's hot take number one. Listen to me. Biblical giving is more than tithing, but never less. What do you mean, Pastor? If you don't tithe, you're not a biblical giver. Period. Whoop. Full stop. Also, hot take number two. I have done countless hospital visits and ending of life visits with senior adults. I can't even count them all. Listen to me. I rarely use the word never. I'm using it now. So take it. I have never heard any one of those senior adults, whether in this county, at this church, in Athens, in South Georgia, in Mississippi, I have never heard one senior adult who is at the end of their life saying, I really wish I'd have given less to the Lord. Never. I've heard a bunch of people say, I wish I'd have given more. I've never heard one single person at the end of their life bemoan how much they tithed to their church. Not one. Biblical giving is more, or biblical generosity and biblical giving is more than tithing, but never less. That is the starting point. So what does tithe mean? Literally, the word tithe means tenth. And giving refers to an offering. All right? How that works in reality is, and I'm going to be very specific here again. In the Bible, tithing is giving 10% of your income or the produce of your land. So in biblical times, it might literally mean if you started with a herd of this many sheep and it grew to this many sheep, that you tithed the 10% of the growth of your sheep for that year. So literally, they might give 10% of the sheep. Well, we just don't operate in that economy anymore, right? So tithing for us today is 10% of our income, right? And I want to be very clear. It is 10% of your income, not 10% of your time or your talent. I've had people in other churches and other places say, when this conversation came up, say, well, Pastor, you know, we don't tithe 10% because we tithe all of it. We give so much time to the church. Good for you. That's part of the equation. That's an offering. That's not tithing. Tithing is specifically 10% of your income. Now, you can ask this question, and I'll answer it for you. Pastor, is that off my gross income or my net income? And I'll tell you what my pastor told me. Do you want God to bless all of it or part of it? I prefer to choose all of it. Right? There you go. All right. 10% of your gross income. That's what tithing refers to. To the church, or Christian causes, I would say to the church, right? Because Jesus is coming back for the church. Love FCA. Jesus didn't come back for the FCA organization. Jesus didn't come back for this and that and this and that. He's come back for the church. We are God's ordained institution to spread the gospel of Jesus, right? Tithing is 10%. Offering is anything above that, right? It is giving of your talents. It is giving of your time. It is giving of more than 10% of your income or your resources, all right? So tithing, 10%. Offering, anything above that. Now, both of those words are used extensively in the Old Testament, but I want to be transparent. Tithing is not used in the New Testament. In fact, there is no dedicated command from Jesus or Paul or Peter, any of the other people in the New Testament, that believers must tithe. But you do have verses like this. So let's read 1 Corinthians. I believe it's 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 6 and following. The point is this: whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, and whoever sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. Each one must give as he has decided in his heart, not reluctantly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver, verse 8. And God is able to make all grace abound to you so that having all sufficiency in all things at all times, you may abound in every good work, verse 9. As it is written, he has distributed freely. He has given to the poor. His righteousness endures forever. Verse 10. He who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will supply and multiply your seed for sowing and increase the harvest of your righteousness. In other words, what Paul is saying, if you sow wimpy, if you sow sparingly, don't expect to get a great harvest in the end. If you sow lavishly, you should expect a lavish. That just makes sense. If you put spring is about to be here. I am ready for it. The cold should pass, right? We've passed Christmas. We got a little snow and ice. Let's move on to spring, right? If you plant two tomato plants in your yard this year, you must not expect to get the same amount as the person who plants 50 tomatoes. So why in the world would we sow sparingly to the Lord and expect the Lord to bless us with these lavish blessings? That's just not how it works. You sow sparingly, you reap sparingly, right? So you say, well, Pastor, should I tithe? Well, here's going to be my response. That's between you and the Lord, right? I can't tell you, you know, 1 Peter and give you a verse that Peter says, all Christians must tithe. I can't do that. That's between you and the Lord, whether you should tithe 10% or not. But let me just put it to you this way. If Old Testament believers who were looking forward tithed, shouldn't New Testament believers who know Jesus and know the end of the story and are waiting and know the resurrection of Christ and are waiting on the return of Christ, should we let Old Testament believers be better than us at giving to the Lord? I don't think so. But that's between you and the Lord. I'm just telling you where I'm at. All right, you take it and you do whatever you want to with it. You and the Lord, your spouse, you pray about it. So, that's the conclusion. Now, here's my blunt statement. Number one, all right, here it is. What can we gather from all of this? If you want to be a growing Christian, if you want to be moving closer to the Lord in your relationship, listen to me, you will tithe. Listen, you will tithe. You will be generous with your money. You will tithe. More specifically, you will tithe to the church. You cannot say, I love the Lord, and be stingy with your money. You cannot say, I love Jesus, yes, and keep your money in your pockets and not give to His kingdom. You will not grow as much as you could. I won't say you won't grow at all. I'm not saying that. You will not grow as close to the Lord as you could, or God will not use you like He wants to if you are stingy with your resources. If you want to grow closer to the Lord, you will be a generous giver. You will tithe. Now, here's my benevolent statement. I told you I had a blunt one. Here's my benevolent. Listen, the Lord knows where you're at. For some of you, this may be the first time you've ever heard a dedicated sermon on tithing, or maybe it's been a while since you've heard that. And you may be thinking right now, oh man, I really need to do that, but there ain't no way we can do 10% right now. I get that. Holly and I have been there. I'll just be real with y'all for a moment. There was a season in our life where Holly and I couldn't tithe. We moved out to Mississippi. We expected living expenses to be one thing, and for us to get paid one thing, and we didn't get paid what we thought we were supposed to get paid, and living expenses were exorbitantly more than we thought, and we literally couldn't tithe. We could tithe off one of our incomes. We couldn't tithe off both of them. And so we did the best we could do, and at every effort we could make to kind of catch up, we would, right? Things happen. The Lord knows where you're at. But here would be my encouragement to you. Start somewhere. Look at your finances, look at your budget and say, okay, what legitimately can we give? Can we do 5%? If you can, start there. You say, hey, we might can do 6, we might can do 3. Start there, but make a plan to work up to giving 10%, because I would say that's kind of the threshold at which we should live. And look, there's some times where you might get a raise and you might forget about it. And you might still be giving what you were giving and you got a raise. But, life happens. It's not like God's up there with the, you know, little ledger book going, Right? And he's not like up there with his wand going, zap, zap, zap. Right? God knows where you're at. But make a plan to begin to be a tither. Right? But benevolent. So how does that work with you and me and here at the church? Now, here's where I want to draw a little bit of math into the equation. All right, so the world is acting with great practical intelligence. We saw that in the parable. Jesus says we must act with great practical intelligence as well. And whether we like it or not, it takes money for us to run and do everything that God's called us to do. So y'all remember when it was like 9 degrees, like 3 weeks ago? Remember when it was like 9 degrees? Guess what? Evergreen, isn't that who we get propane? Evergreen Propane did not call up here and say, hey, church, we know it's going to be 9 degrees. We're just going to come give y'all some free propane. You know what they did? They brought that propane truck out, filled it up, and left a bill. Hey, EMC, we get our power through the EMC, ups in EMC. Jim's even on the board. Guess what? They send us a bill every week. Every month, just like they send you. The internet that it takes to do all this, guess what? Spectrum doesn't say, y'all are a church, we just can give it to you for free. No, we pay the same bills you do, right? Logan, Audrey, and myself are very, 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 very thankful that you are very generous to us in giving us salaries that allow us to be able to do the things we do and to provide money for us to have VBS and Wednesday night for kids, teenagers to go on a trip, and all of that takes money. So I want us to look at it in just a little bit of detail really quickly. Ren, will you throw up our first slide? All right, that right there is our total budget for this year. So that means our finance team sat down and did all the numbers and put a spreadsheet together and said, we need this amount of money to do everything we'd like to do this year. All right, you see that number? All right, next slide. All right, 39. All right, that is the number of total giving units that, now let me explain that. A giving unit is generally a family. All right, so, there's a little bit of variation. So for example, Holly, myself, and Tucker. Tucker has a small job, and so he tithes off his job, but we're all three considered one giving unit because he's not quite an adult yet. All right, so us three are one giving unit. But if you're single and it's just you, you're a giving unit. Or if you have a family, like and you live at home, but you're an adult who has a job and pays bills, you're a giving unit. And so basically we had 39 different giving units who gave at least one time last year. So here's the simple math. If you divide the top number by 39, here's the average right here. All right, that means in order to meet budget, we need that per giving unit for the entire year. All right, You got you with me so far? For the entire year. That means each giving unit, whether only one of you works in the giving unit, two of you work, three of you work, whatever. That's the average that we need per giving unit to meet our budget. Now, let me show you how this works. Now, let's just assume for just a minute, okay? That's the real numbers. Let's just assume that all 39 of those giving units tithed 10%. So we're going to do a little math to figure out what the gross income for this family would be. All right, Ren, show us that right there. So if your family, whether you're single, married and both working, married and one working, adult child working in the house, however all that shakes out, teenagers, whatever. If your family made that number right there, and all of us tithed, we would meet budget. Now, I know you don't have, look, I'll tell you, you can know what I make because you can go look at the budget. You can know what Holly makes by going on the Thomas and Upson school and you can just figure it out probably. So I don't have a problem. I don't know what you make. That's fine. It's between you and the Lord. But let me just tell you, I can look to the parking lot over here and to the parking lot over here and tell you that the majority of us as families are making more than that. Just reality. Just reality. Now, some of you may say, Pastor, I don't make that much. There's no way. Like, I'm on a fixed income. I'm on Social Security. That's fine. You know, this is the beauty about it, is if all of us tithe, then those of us who are working and make more help out with those of us who don't make as much. But I'm saying, my point is, if each family made this, and tithed, we would meet budget. Do you know this number is less than the National Institute of Health statistics for the median income for Upson County? This right here, see that number? That is the median household income for Upson County from the years 2019 to 2023. That number. Now, if each family just made the median income, here's what that would look like. And we all tithe? $6,678. You say, well, that's not technically right. I round it up, okay? Give me a little grace. I round it up. Right there. So here's what I'm trying to get you to understand, is if you tithed and I tithe, here's blunt statement number two. You ready? Listen to me. Listen. Stay with me. If you tithed off your income and I tithed off my income last year, we would not have been $11,000 underfunded. So the question I have to ask is, why were we $11,000 underfunded? Let me give you the answer. There's only one. Some of us did not tithe last year. That's the only answer. No, that is the answer. Because I can tell you that a lot of us probably make more than the median income, right? So here's the reality. We need you to tithe. If you tithed and I tithed and we tithe, there is no telling what we could do. We would not have to worry about money at all. We could do anything and everything. And there's things we need to start doing. But when you're $11,000 underfunded, the thing you might need to do doesn't get done. Why? Because you're $11,000 underfunded. I mean, it's just a reality, right? So here's the deal, friends. We desperately need you to tithe. Now, I'm about to land the plane on this, okay? I need you to tithe not just because of last year or not just because of this year. Here's why I need you to start tithing. All right? I need you to tithe because we need to meet our budget. Like there's things we need to do. There's things we want to do this year for the kingdom, for the sake of the kingdom, that we have to have your help doing. And we can do it if all of us tithe. All right? But here's more. Listen, I'm almost done, I promise. Here's why I need you to start tithing. And I want you to think of it from a legacy standpoint. The reason, I'm going to pick on Tucker just for a minute. The reason Tucker tithes today, do you know why he tithes today? Listen, because his great-grandparents were tithers on multiple sides. His great, you say, well, how were his great-grandparents the reason he tithes today? Let me tell you, because his great-grandparents taught my parents the necessity of tithing. And Holly's grandparents, his great-grandparents on Holly's side, taught her mom and dad the necessity of tithing. Then taught us the necessity of tithing. That then pass it on to him, and when his brother starts making some money, his brother will be in the same boat. Okay? Generational givers, because some people back in the 40s, 30s, decided we were going to give to the Lord. And listen to me, friends, that can be you. You can be the grandparents or the great-grandparents who look back and say, I'm giving today because, and your name comes up, and your name comes up because you were diligent to be about the Lord's business of giving to His cause, using great practical intelligence to move the kingdom on. It's about your legacy, and it's about our legacy here today. Friends, we are here today because people hundreds of years ago decided it was necessary for us to tithe and to give. And I want that same thing to happen for people that are here 50 and 75 years after we're gone. And so the challenge for you today is very simple. When you get home, on your way home, you need to have a conversation about tithing with your family. And God knows where you're at. This is benevolent part number two. God knows where you're at. He knows what you're going through. He knows exactly where you're at. He knows that this may be the first time in a long time or in a while that you've heard something like this. And so you may be thinking, oh, have a conversation with the Lord about it. Start somewhere and make a plan to tithe. I can promise you, you will be better off for it. And you will be drawn closer to the Lord in a growing relationship with Him.
Thanks for listening. For more information about Valley Grove, visit our Facebook page or website, valleygrovechurch.org.